So it's 4:20 on a Thursday, and I'm sitting in a very small closet with my coworker Hillary, who is now my new co-anchor for the podcast.
Hey. Let's look at what we've got going on for Record Store Day Black Friday, which is, of course, the day after Thanksgiving where everyone loses their minds and tramples all the other humans to get Tickle Me Elmos and stuff.
Ugh. I'm not down.
If you're not in the mood to trample fellow humans, you can stand in line at a record store and grab your handy Record Store Day release that you might enjoy.
A little less. Not zero bloodshed, but...
We have a couple of Black Friday Record Store Day official releases, including a comp that includes Dunyan. It's a little bit of a departure from our normal...
regularly scheduled programming.
Yeah, because it features mostly contemporary artists.
Yeah, so this this comp that Hillary's talking about is a joint release that we're doing with our friend Justin Gage, a.k.a. Aquarium Drunkard.
Shout out, Aquarium Drunkard!
So he, if you don't know, on his amazing music blog, does these Lanyap sessions where contemporary musicians stop by and record covers of their favorite artists. So it's... 12 tracks, and you got like White Fence covering Gin Blossoms, Allison Road, really amazing cover. You've got Of Montreal covering All My Sorrows, made famous by Kingston Trio. There's Dunyan. How do you say that? I have no idea.
Dunyan? Yeah.
Covering Aphex Twin, Alberto
Which
Balsam.
Is awesome.
My fave is Kevin Morby covering The Germs, Caught in My Eye. It's really amazing, and that's actually up on our YouTube right now as, like, the album preview.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a beautiful comp with some amazing music, and that'll be out in record stores only on November 25th for Record Store Day.
Black Friday.
Gold Wax.
Gold Wax, Black Friday. Also, speaking of Record Store Day, we're going to talk a little bit about a release that came out last year on Record Store Day, the box set deluxe edition of Heartworn Highways that came out last year, 2016, or this year, this past Record Store Day, 2016.
It was a documentary that was filmed in 1976 and released in 1981 about the outlaw country movement in Austin and Nashville, sort of led by Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark and David Allan Coe.
Steve Earle, Steve Young,
Larry John Wilson. Yeah, so this episode is about Heartworn Highways. We're going to interview Matt and Patrick. Matt is the founder of Lightning Attic and our boss man, and Patrick is project manager. After that, we have Sam Sweet reading his liner notes for the box set. Sam is an amazing writer based here in Los Angeles and a good friend of ours. And we're going to play some music from the album, and it's going to be really chill.
So, Matt, you're wearing an anorak.
Yeah, I'm cold right now.
It's like 75 degrees outside.
My feet are cold. I'm cold. It rained last night.
Well, we're glad to have you and Patrick here with us today. We're going to talk to you guys about the Heartworn Highways project. Patrick. Do you remember the first time you saw the documentary?
Yeah, the first time I saw Heartworn Highways was, I think it was probably 2003 or two. I was living in New York, and I was working at a burger joint called Bonnie's Grill in Park Slope. And it was an amazing place, still there. And the two owners were really big music heads. And one of the owners, a guy named Mike Neighbor, he was a former buyer for Sounds, great record store in the East Village on St. Mark's Place, no longer there. But he was a buyer for Sounds and just like was a huge music head. And I think I had told him that I really liked Townes Van Zandt. And he said, oh, have you ever seen this movie, Heartworn Highways? And I said, no, I've never heard of it. I don't know what it is. And the next week he brought me in a VHS tape of the film. So the first time I saw it was on VHS, because before it was ever on DVD, it was a really hard film to see. And the VHS was like $100 tape, you know, if you could find one. And it was before the soundtrack had been reissued and all that stuff. So it was really hard to watch. And so I borrowed the VHS and I took it home and watched it. And it was, so it's probably 2002, 2003. It was amazing to see. This is before YouTube and all this stuff. I'd never seen it.
Before YouTube.
Before YouTube. You know, this, like, everyone knows the famous scenes from this movie now, but at the time, you know, I had a lot of Towns records. I had some Guy Clark stuff. I didn't really know. I knew David Allan Coe, but I didn't know Steve Earle that much. I didn't know Steve Young. And, you know, I was familiar with the songs, some of the songs in the film, but, you know, seeing those images of them when they're playing these songs, like, on the tape, especially on VHS, it was, like, all, like, it was old, and, like, it was just kind of, the sound was weird, all that stuff. I think I recorded the audio off of the VHS into, like, a mini disc recorder that I had so that I could listen to it. But, yeah, so that was the first time I saw it, and I thanked him in the liner notes for turning me on to this so many years ago.
One thing to note, too, coming to think of this again, I feel like my first maybe introduction to Heart One Highways was the Be Here to Love Me Towns Van Zandt doc, which used the Towns Uncle Seymour scene, which I hadn't really thought, I didn't know that was a reference to an earlier film. So obviously Heart One Highways. So I think a lot of people are kind of, because that Be Here to Love Me Towns doc is, it's a great documentary, but it also, I think, opened up the world to some people of this scene. Mm-hmm. So just wanted to say that little side note there.
No, that's good.
Controversial scene.
It's great. Yeah, it's a good scene, but yes. So back to the
I was going to ask. Programming. So that was the first time you saw the documentary, and how many times do you think you've seen it now, Patrick? Because I know you had to watch it 5 million times during production.
As my job entails here, I'm project manager, so I have to, you know, listen to this stuff, read all the notes many times. And when we do film restoration, that includes watching the film lots of times to make sure that we're happy with the way it's been restored. We have to remaster the audio and then watch it, make sure it's synced to the picture. And sometimes it goes out of sync and you have to, you know, make notes. It's all boring stuff, but yet it usually involves me watching the film a lot of times. But before we worked on it, I probably saw the film maybe like a handful of times. And then since we've started working on it, I probably maybe 12 times, I would say.
Whoa. I just remember we had a Light in the Attic movie night at Matt's house so that those of us who hadn't seen the doc could all watch it. And Patrick was like not stoked that he had to.
I love the movie, but you know, when you've seen something so many times, I can pretty much like, you know, reenact the film at this point for you.
It's like me and Hocus Pocus.
Yeah, you and Hocus Pocus. So, but you know, but it's a great, it stands up to repeated viewing because there's so many, I mean, it's more than just a music doc. It's a piece, like a social history piece and like a documentation of a time.
Capsule.
Yeah. And so when you watch it, like, I just like the scene, you know, when Towns is in the yard and you see like a car go by, and you're like, oh, what kind of car is that? And mm-hmm. like, you're like, and then I got really, when we did this project, Sam Sweet, you know, wrote the liner notes. He did so much amazing research, like finding the exact addresses of these places. And I got obsessed with Google mapping everything. And like,
your fave.
Yeah, my favorite. So I like looked at where like the house where they lived, where Towns lived, where he falls in the hole by the rabbits. Like mm-hmm. it's now like, there's like a mansion there now. It shows how Austin changes, you know. Yeah. It was like the poorest area. And now it's like, McDonald mansions, or whatever they're called.
McMansions.
Sorry, McDonald's. So yeah, like there's stuff like that that's like amazing. And like if you go to Long Beach, you can go to the house where Towns lived with Guy Clark, which is really cool. I drove by that this past weekend. We were
still
out there.
It's so weird to me that they were out in Long Beach for a period, you know?
Yeah, Long Beach had a scene.
Well, I think the thought you put into it shows, because it is a very beautiful set. What is the historical and cultural significance of this set?
For me, I think it's these people are captured at a time where it's like the perfect, you said time capsule earlier, someone did, but mm-hmm. it's kind of the perfect time capsule of these two scenes, and or really one scene, but also to Austin and Nashville. And for a lot of these artists, at least me personally, it's my favorite era of their careers. So, you know, Towns, Guy Clark, Larry John Wilson, David Allan Coe. I mean, some of these artists, the honest truth is, and I think this was in Sam's notes, if 6 months later, if the New York crew would have went out and tried to make this movie, it would have been a whole different movie. And I don't, it probably wouldn't have been as good. So it's just so genuine. It doesn't, there's no, I don't know, there's just no kind of blatant commercialism to it, or just, it's just these guys are kind of, you know, capturing their own little behind the scenes way. And I don't know, it's just beautiful. I love, like, to go back to the, some photos of the book. I just love the almost the B-roll shots in the film. It's like kind of captures so much of those two cities and those two cities at the time. And, you know, not just the characters, meaning the musicians in the film, but, you know, the local characters. And it's just, I don't know, for me, it's, yes, maybe I'm biased after spending a long time on this project, but, for me, it's like one of the best music, you know, docs or films ever made. I mean, it holds up, and you don't really even have to be familiar with these artists. I mean, it's just, it's so beautifully shot and put together and edited. And, that's, for me, why I think it needs to be revisited, and also just needs to be available.
Great. Yeah.
Some capacity.
Is there anything that you would like people to know about the project that's not in the liner notes or on the soundtrack?
Sam Sweet's based in the liner notes writer is based in Los Angeles, but his mom lives in New York City, and so he went out to visit her, and he decided when he was out there, he's going to try to maybe do an interview or two and kind of connect with some people who might still be around, who worked on the film. And he hooked up with Philip Schopper, who was the original editor of the film. And I think he kind of, actually before he did meet up with Philip, he kind of suggested, oh, maybe I'll try it with Philip and try to meet up with Philip. And I said, yeah, you know, why not? But I didn't really think that, you know, they'd already talked on the phone. And Sam being Sam, like he's a kind of the, you know, the, one of those
crazy thorough
researchers who like gets to the heart of whatever needs to be, just found. I mean, the guy is like, I've never met anyone like him. He's, you know, God bless his soul for everything he puts into these projects, and like his documentation or just archival work is like nobody out there. So he meets up with Philip, and in passing, Philip kind of says, oh, I might have some more, you know, stuff that you guys might want to use, but I didn't send it to you just because I didn't really think you'd care, but you're sitting here in my house, so why not? And ends up, he sends us his box that was like, I mean, it was like the sea parted. It was like, blew our minds.
Christmas morning.
It was like Christmas morning. It was like this giant box, and it had over 200, you know, photos and negatives and the original press kit from 1977 and all the, some film festival, you know, press clippings. And I mean, it was like the marketing plan from the 70s, like the original pictures. Yeah, it's in the inside of the book. The original posters when the movie was called New Country and not called Heartworn Highways. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, he kept everything, but he didn't think anybody would really care about it. And I think looking, you know, when you're deep into your own stuff, you don't really realize, like, anyone outside your little world might care about it. So I totally understood where he was coming from. But, you know, thank God for Sam kind of pushing him and for Philip to believing in us. And so he's Philip sending it. It totally changed the life of the project, because without that, it would have been a good project and, you know, done well. But like, it gave us the resources and the opportunity to like give this thing justice, what it really deserved. So yeah, we could.
That was like sort of the day when we realized this wasn't just going to be like regular liner notes. It was going to be kind of like a book and like,
yeah,
really
something
to add to the story.
A lot deeper.
If you could go out, have a night drinking with any of these guys, who would you choose and why?
That's easy. Larry John Wilson.
Why?
He's my favorite. He's my favorite in the film. I love his records, but also he just has such a great vibe. And we heard a story about before they shoot the scene with him in the movie, they go to pick him up at his hotel because he never shows up or something. And he's just like in bed and cannot get out of bed because he has the worst hangover ever. He shows up at the studio and kills it. I mean, it's like the most amazing it's the opening, for me, it's scene, right? Opening scene. It's killer. He's so good. And I just love, he just seems like such a lovable uncle, you know. I just want to like have some whiskeys with that.
He kind of has Santa Claus face.
Yeah, he totally, he'd be a really good Santa Claus. Yeah, him for sure. Patrick?
Ooh. I mean, could I say I would like to be at the Christmas Eve party where they're totally all at, and then you're drinking with most of them?
That's kind of cheating, though.
That's cheating. You know, I think I would like to have met someone like Towns in person, but I also think, you know, he was always kind of in his doing his character, you know, being his personality. It would have been fun to party with him, but I would have you know, hang out with Guy Clark and like sit there while he like fixes a guitar and like learn about that kind of stuff. And you know, a lot of these guys, they just seemed so, they all seemed so open to sharing, you know, because that's inherent in the heart of these kind of songwriting circles, where they call them like guitar pools, where you kind of sit around and you just like, show me that lick, or like, check out this song, and like, oh, I might borrow that line. And you know, there's like a lot of that kind of openness that you see in the film. So I think any one of those guys would have been great, but yeah, Larry John would have been next level. To
I thought for sure one of you was going to say David Allan Coe, just well, to like Dave, see what would happen.
I mean,
a night with the Stone Cowboy.
Would get naked.
So when I first saw this, when I saw this movie for the first time, that was the thing that, I mean, I was blown away by all the amazing scenes, but I was completely blown away by David Allan Coe, because growing up in Florida, where he lives, and like, you know, I grew up knowing about him, and like, you'd hear, like, I knew some of his songs, and then when I started to get into this stuff, I got really into a lot of David Allan Coe, because it was just the weirdest sounding music to me. Like, there was all these like phasers on the guitars, and he's wearing like glitter boots. He looks like a glam rocker. I mean, he just seems like a character. And I was like, this is some sort of performance artist who's just like trying to play a joke on people or something like
just
that.
Just a Florida man.
No, he's not from, but yeah, I'm talking about like, I mean, he invented his whole story. Like he, you know, all the stuff, it's like, he's like Dylan, you know, he like made up his whole, copied Dylan, and he like made up this whole life story about being in prison, and you know, it's all this character you're building up. And that's what's interesting to me. It's like, this music is so, people look at like this kind of country stuff, it's like everyone is so authentic. It's like this is who they really are. But no, it's like all these people are, it's all mythologizing yourself. It's all creating these worlds that
always
now, it is. It's still, and this, you know? It's art. That's what art is. You're making up some stuff doesn't mean it's still not authentic in the character you're making. So, but yeah, David Allan Coe with his little earrings and like hanging out at the prison. That would have been a wild time.
We did.
Well, thanks, guys.
Yay.
Hey, record. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
The podcast.
Every city with a college had a coffee house. When Towns was around, he and Guy would pick up one-nighters at campuses and folk clubs within a day's drive of Houston. In Austin, the Checkered Flag. In Beaumont, the Halfway Coffee House. In Tulsa, the Dust Bowl. After a stop at the Sword and Stone Coffee House in Oklahoma City, they ended up in the apartment of a Dylan devotee named Bunny Tally and her older sister, Susanna, who taught art at the Oklahoma Science and Arts Foundation, which had been founded with contributions from their mother's family. Two of 10 siblings, the sisters had grown up in Atlanta, Texas, south of Texarkana, and moved to Oklahoma City when their dad's business took off. Knowing Bunny and Guy had a thing, Susanna sized up the two Houston long hairs, Guy with the dark brow and square chin, and Towns, gallant and goofy. They were skinny as rails. She offered them a vitamin pill, as Guy studied the easel she was working on in the middle of the room. When he asked what she planned to do about the foreground, she grappled for an answer. You know what to do, Guy said.
Just dying words. That's the way it goes.
Bunny led the rail-thin long hairs away to a party, and they subsequently blew town. Towns' New York management had booked them a showcase at Carnegie Hall with other artists on the fledgling hippie label Poppy.
I'd play the Red River Valley
In May 1970, when Let It Be was new and everyone was mourning the Beatles, Jack Prigg died, aged 83. Stricken with grief, Guy was on his way back to Monahan's for the funeral when he got a call from Susanna Talley. Bunny had killed herself with a gunshot to the head. Susanna was inconsolable. Guy said he'd stop in Oklahoma City on his way back from Monahan's. They held hands at Bunny's memorial. From then on, they were together.
Was like desperado, waiting for a train. Was like desperado, waiting for a train.
That July 4th, Susanna moved in with Guy in Houston, where he was living in a communal flop house in Montrose, the heart of Houston's counterculture. Everyone was taking hallucinogens. Long hairs dangled from windows. All the young songwriters and pickers hung out at the Old Quarter, a converted speakeasy on the outskirts of downtown Houston, operated by Dale Sofer and Rex Bell, two eccentric Jewish folk singers stranded in cowboy country. It was run more as a front for some marijuana dealers than a club, said John Lomax III, a friend to both owners. The schedule was loose. Guy or Towns or Jerry Jeff could play whenever they felt like it. Once in a while, a touring band like the Allman Brothers might end up there, as much for the company of the dealers as the music. The Old Quarter served liquor, and joints were enjoyed in the privacy of the roof. Nobody minded if you went behind the bar to pour your own beer. Ma Carrick finally caved and bought a liquor license, but by that point, Sand Mountain didn't stand a chance. At the flop house, Susanna tried to paint. She started fiddling with a life-size portrait of the denim work shirt that Guy liked to wear. Mostly, she was miserable, an uprooted debutante with a degree in psychology and philosophy, left to grieve for her sister among the reckless acid pranksters of Houston. Between recording dates in Nashville and his never-ending touring cycle, Towns would suddenly appear, the only soul who seemed to recognize the sadness invisible to the rest of the world. One night at the house, he placed his arms on her shoulders and said, "If Guy loves you, I love you." Susanna later said it was the first time she felt as if someone meant it. "It was so touching to me, and for the first time, I felt at home." To escape the city's summer heat, Guy and Susanna and Towns took a road trip into the forested San Gabriel Mountains in the VW bus. Towns built them a campfire in the dark and they traded songs all night. On the way back down, Towns improvised a new song on the spot. "No deal, you can't sell that stuff to me. No deal, I'm going back to Tennessee."
First song I ever wrote about.
Is it? I have no idea.
It's about an old man I met in the bar.
They were a triangle of closeness. Guy and Susanna were married partners. Guy and Towns were best friends. Susanna and Towns were soulmates. In early August, as Towns put the finishing touches on the album that would become High, Low, and In Between, Leslie Joe Richards was abducted while hitchhiking back to Houston from San Diego. She crawled onto a stranger's doorstep in Leucadia Beach and begged for help as she bled to death from the stab wounds. Towns called Guy and Susanna. For once, he refused to come to Long Beach. He asked them to come north to Los Angeles so he could tell them in person. They found him inconsolable. The trio grieved, three united by losses.
Down to Tennessee. Oh, it's easier than just a waiting round to die.
That fall, Towns retreated to the bleak side of Houston. He overdosed on heroin at his mother's house. At the hospital, they managed to revive him, but they had to knock out his front teeth to get a breathing tube down his throat. Afterwards, he got a gold tooth installed, just like Lightning's. Meanwhile, after playing for an RCA rep in Los Angeles, Guy was finally offered the publishing contract he'd been chasing. For $50 a week, Sunbury Dunbar, RCA's publishing division, would own a piece of anything he wrote. He was told that he could live in L.A., New York, or Nashville. He and Susanna had seen enough of the big city. Guy knew he could stay with Mickey Newbury in Nashville. RCA told him to bring a tape with him. Before he left, Guy recorded a 6-song demo in the living room of John Penn's house in Seal Beach, with Dennis thrumming his bass in the background. The songs were That Old-Time Feeling, Step Inside This House, Waitress, Waitress, Texas Goodbyes, Texas Bound, and The Old Mother's Locket Trick. He had found his voice in images of the Texas he'd left behind, but the first song he finished when he got to Nashville was a goodbye to Los Angeles.
Pack up all your dishes, make note of all good wishes, and say goodbye to the landlord for me. Some bitches always bore me.
When Guy and Susanna moved into a cheap two-bedroom house on Chapel Avenue in the rundown black section of East Nashville, Towns crashed for a night and ended up staying for 6 months. He moved into the spare bedroom that Susanna had intended for her painting studio, spreading a sleeping bag atop a mattress they found behind a local Safeway. His military school discipline showed in the way he made his bed every morning and washed every dish, but his mischief soon drove Guy up a wall. Towns had come home with louts who'd lost bets to him in bars or miscellaneous college girls. "I'd wake up in the morning and there'd be blondes under the couch," said Susanna. One time, Towns came back from the airport with a proud grin and a pair of parakeets tucked into his jacket. Watching Loop and Lil fly around the house became part of their morning routine at the kitchen table, which was where most of their playing and writing happened. They were broke but happy, irresponsible but productive. Guy was getting $50 a week to write for Sunbury Dunbar, and he got his first cut when the Everly Brothers recorded The Old Mother's Locket Trick on their final LP, but most of the proceeds were sent back to Houston for child support. Towns had a record deal with Poppy, but it never paid. There was no television, no furniture, no food. "I lusted for mayonnaise," said Susanna. They raided record industry parties for booze, and whenever Guy or Towns got a song placement, they'd celebrate by buying liquor or new paint for Susanna. She had the best laugh anyone had ever heard, and she was the only one who could puncture the pretense if any of the songwriters started taking themselves too seriously. Hard drinking was constant and compulsory. Susanna trained herself to keep pace with the boys, which only made them love her more. She later claimed the only peace she got was when Towns and Guy both got the flu. She was so happy to have the house to herself, she finished her first painting in months, the image of a red delicious apple bouncing cheerfully across a white background. While Guy forged his songs a line at a time, Towns claimed his work came to him from the clouds. He'd come back from a trip and play Poncho and Lefty, saying it arrived one night in a Dallas motel room. One morning, he arrived at the kitchen table and played Guy and Susanna If I Needed You, fully formed, telling them it had come to him in his sleep. Susanna thought it was wonderful. Guy refused to believe that nonsense, but he couldn't help but be blown away by the song. In Franklin, desperate to dry out, Towns had Cindy chain him to a tree and leave him a half pint of vodka and an orange soda. Nothing worked. Worried about his productivity, he eventually locked himself inside a Nashville motel room and emerged with the beginnings of Flying Shoes, the first song he'd written in 3 years. He later claimed it was inspired by the ghosts of Confederate soldiers that roamed the property near the Harpeth River. It eventually appeared on an album by the same name, alongside reworkings of tunes from the aborted 7x11 sessions. John Lomax's hopes of rekindling Van Zandt's career were derailed when he and Ewa crashed their truck into a tree while driving drunk back to Franklin one night. Towns escaped with a deep scar below his right eye and a broken arm. The nerve damage in his hands left him permanently unable to execute the finely embroidered finger picking of his early songs. Heavy drinking caused his voice to drop an octave. He could still perform with elegance and tenderness, but now he dragged and strained to get through songs in which he used to sail. He'd unplug the phone the rest of the day, Cindy told the writer Robert Earl Hardy, but by God, he'd wake up and call Susanna every morning. Years later, Susanna recalled the contents of their conversation in a short memoir. They'd talk about what Guy was doing or how Susanna wanted to paint Cindy because of the way her hair caught the sunlight. They talked about art and artists and history, especially Texas history. Towns would list all the different types of love that existed in the world and attempted to describe each in detail. When Susanna chided him for drinking too much, he'd say, "Hey, there are sober people in India." If she was upset, he'd make her laugh. If she was distressed, he had only to say, "Oh, babe," and she'd feel better. Towns was the only man she'd let call her babe. Once in a while, he'd say, "Susanna, if Guy and Cindy died at the very same time, would you marry me?" Susanna always said yes, at which point Towns would always say, "I'll fix the brakes tomorrow."
Place for beer and bars, like an old time blues picker. Don't call who you are.
Cindy finally left him. Towns abandoned Franklin and moved back to Austin, where he married a waitress and had two kids. In March 1983, Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson's version of Emmylou Harris's Poncho and Lefty hit number one, the biggest song of either's career. The success gave Van Zandt a boost, but his old publishing contract shortchanged him on compensation. With his albums out of print, he'd tour Europe to make a living, often in a pair with Mickey White. Mickey looked like a little rascal next to Towns, who slowly evolved from a gallant prince into a bony seer, long coarse hair and brightly colored shirts. As his kids grew and he got frailer, Towns made repeated attempts at sobriety, but it never took. Eventually, his wife threw him out of their house in suburban Smyrna, and he started living in a hotel in Nashville. When his wife finally divorced him, Suzanne and Guy sold him their lake house in Mount Juliet. Towns nicknamed it Bayou Self. He'd take a small sailboat called the Snark out on Old Hickory Lake. He loved feeding wood to the fireplace on cold nights. He rarely wrote. On the occasions that they came to him, the songs were plain, masterful, and uncomfortably bleak. Just before his death, Towns fell, broke his hip, and ignored it until it was infected. At the hospital, he begged for vodka. When refused, he demanded to be taken home to Mount Juliet, against the orders of doctors. He asked to talk to Susanna on the phone from his bed in the room where she and Guy used to sleep. Afterwards, his ex-wife put some food in front of him. Towns thanked her and then expired. He was 52. It was New Year's Day, 1997, 50 years to the day after the death of Hank Williams, and 21 years to the week after some filmmakers from New York had knocked on the door of his trailer.
Keeping close to the wall.
On that trip, they met the guys in Barefoot Jerry, who were the toast of the Exit Inn, and Lomax introduced Salapsky to David Allan Coe, a songwriter best known for Cruising Town and a hearse plastered with his name. Coe had a, quote, "rap sheet as thick as the Manhattan phone book," end quote, equaled only by the breadth of the tall tales he spouted. He'd been abandoned as a child and claimed he'd spent a combined 20 years of his life in correctional institutions before coming to Nashville in the late 1960s to make a play as a songwriter. He said his body was covered with 365 tattoos, and in prison, he'd once had to kill a man with a mop handle for trying to rape him. Recently, Coe had taken to wearing a Zorro mask on stage and calling himself the Mysterious Rhinestone Cowboy. He was shameless, to be sure, but Guy Clark respected his singing and his songs. So what if he embellished his backstory to get heard? So had Bob Dylan and Ramblin' Jack Elliott. They'd all heard the tales of Christofferson landing a helicopter on Johnny Cash's lawn to get noticed. In Nashville, it didn't matter if you were obnoxious, as long as you had the songs to back up the bluster. As Coe's bus pulled past the gate, Zalapsky and his crew relished their fortune, the chance to film a primeval penitentiary from the inside. Mike Harris took a snapshot of each crew member as they waited to be admitted. Everyone wore a look of nervousness except Harris, who turned the camera on himself and mugged a screaming face. They made sure to get plenty of photos of Mike with his arms thrown around the guards, oblivious to the bearded man's status as a draft dodger. The guards showed them around the prison grounds, including Death Row and Old Sparky, their showpiece electric chair. It had killed 125 men between 1909 and 1956. The prison had a tradition of music dating back to the 1950s, when vocal harmony group The Prisoners formed there before going on to record for Sun Records. Coe had played The Prison once in 1972 on a bill with Sammy Smith, Pete Drake, and a fellow prisoner-turned-singer named Glenn Shirley. Save for those in solitary, everyone in the prison was allowed to the concert, held beneath the basketball hoops in the gymnasium. Prisoners who didn't mind being filmed could sit on the lift floor, while those who wished not to be on camera were encouraged to take the bleachers where Graham Leader was anxiously stationed. "It was terrifying, honestly," said Graham, who'd never been inside a prison, aside from one night in Notting Hill Gate after I'd been arrested for climbing up a girlfriend's drainpipe. To Leader, the tension in the bleachers was palpable, especially when Coe paused between songs to launch a rant about corruption among the guards. The prison scene was the last thing they filmed. Coe drove them back into Nashville, where he checked into the Spence Hotel, the longtime accommodation for Nashville personalities of a certain stature. Philip, Alvar, Larry, and Mike flew back to New York. That night, Graham and Jim filmed Coe in his room at the Spence, doing I Still Sing the Old Songs. While they were there, a few roadies dropped in to deliver the message that Willie would be amenable to playing a few songs for the cameras. Graham and Jim confirmed and made the decision to politely decline. At this late stage, they didn't want or need a star. They had already fought for and found the film they'd come for. Lately. Clarksville had been a black neighborhood since the 1860s, when it was the first part of Austin where freed slaves could own land. Most of the older residents were suspicious of the hippies, long-haired and braless, that had started trickling into the neighborhood in the early 70s, but the newcomers had Seymour Washington's blessing, and that was enough. Uncle Seymour, or Unc, as almost everyone called him, had lived for 40 years on 12th Street, in a small wood-framed house with dark papered walls. In his memoir, The Gulf Coast Boys, Richard Dobson described the property. He had running water in the kitchen, but only an outside privy where his bird dog, Jim, was chained. His other dog, a little terrier that stayed by him, was named Peppy. Unc's front porch featured an assortment of old chairs and a sagging couch. An ancient pickup truck that had not moved in years rested in the yard, along with a barbecue smoker made from a 55-gallon oil drum. The porch was the focal point, a neighborhood gathering place where people would stop to pass a few minutes or an afternoon. Unc was famous for his barbecues, where he would pass the bottle and regale his young audience with stories from ancient Austin. He'd tell them about Congress Street before there were cars, and his days as the walking blacksmith of Dripping Springs. After a few drinks, he'd start quoting from the Bible, but no one ever saw him get angry. That's where I rest when it's time. Towns and Cindy parked their trailer on an empty lot where 11th Street turned at a right angle into Charlotte, a few blocks from Unc's place and not far from the Sweet Home Baptist Church. A fleet of abandoned cars surrounded the trailer. On a post by the driveway hung an aged sign reading, "Member, Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers." Chickens and goats roamed the property along with Geraldine, a black and gray husky mix who'd followed Towns and Cindy down from Crested Butte. When the crew visited Unc's house, it was much too cold to barbecue. Instead, they huddled inside Seymour's as Towns agreed to play a few songs on a borrowed guitar, maybe feeling a little guilty that he'd dogged them the day before. He did Waiting Round to Die, the first song he'd ever written, in Puncho and Lefty, his most popular, which he introduced by saying, "I'll play a medley of my hit," a line he would reuse on stage for years to come. Right off the bat, Lord, I'm not gonna be bad. He looked more presentable than he had the day before, but they had to shoot him from the left, as the previous day's shenanigans had left an ugly scrape on his right temple. The filmmakers were astonished when Seymour broke down in tears during Waiting Round to Die. The Clarksville crowd was more cynical. Seymour put on those old blacksmith clothes that he never wore and put on a show for the goddamn video people, said Phyllis Ivey. Phony bullshit. If you want to tell the truth, tell it. Ivy often stopped by Seymour's to do the dishes and his laundry, but she refused to have any part in the film. Instead, her friend Kathy Tennell took her place. She wasn't a Clarksville person, said Ivy, but she was willing to do that bullshit. Ivy refused to believe that Seymour wept because of Townes' play. I know Unc, she said. He would not ever cry over that song. Unc was sensitive, and she believed he was moved to tears because Townes made fun of him in front of the guests. All of his friends knew the cruelty that came out when Townes started drinking. Afterwards, in lieu of a barbecue, Seymour demonstrated his blacksmithing technique in the yard for the filmmakers. Austin appeared beautifully chilly and barren. Graham Leader rejected the notion that the scene had been in any way staged. Zlapsky was always interested in observing the workings of a certain job, or the procedures by which a certain product was created. Seymour had volunteered to show them his blacksmithing technique. I have no memory of it being phony bullshit in any way, said Leader, of the moment where Seymour shed tears. There was nothing but warmth and cheer between Townes and Seymour. It tarnishes it to suggest otherwise. Townes didn't even own a guitar at the time. The red Gibson he played for the cameras was on loan from Richard Dobson. For years after, viewers who saw the close-up of her washing dishes mistook Kathy Tennell for a Clarksville local, if not Townes' girlfriend or Seymour's caretaker, rather than a visitor. For all that a film can show to be true, each frame, by definition, must leave out more than it can ever include. Clarksville was a place where two people could have drastically different experiences of the same thing. The footage shot there is compelling not only for what's shown within the frame, but because of everything unspoken and unseen. It's true, there was not a lot of spontaneous guitar playing in Clarksville, even though that was a big part of what we were doing, said Mickey White. On a normal day, we'd probably be more interested in getting the first jug of booze and getting the grill fired up for some chickens. I was surprised when I saw Unc cry on film. I think that he's aware they were making a movie and that he could allow himself a bit of emotion for the moment. But his love for Townes was true. He loved that Townes was a storyteller. But Townes and Unc both would have been aware of the moment. I really believe Townes was consciously creating his story as he went along. I've seen him sober as a dove and act drunk, and I've seen him act drunk and play his way sober. Blowing gigs, entertaining the cameras, all of it was part of the self-image he was creating. On their first morning in Nashville, they had an appointment to film Larry John Wilson playing inside Creative Workshop. Of all the up-and-comers Jim had scouted for the movie, Wilson was his favorite. Wilson knew Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt, but he wasn't part of their circle. He had moved to Nashville in 74, abandoning his job at United Merchants and Manufacturers in Langley, South Carolina, where he'd worked for 10 years as a technical consultant in fiberglass manufacturing. An unsolicited demo won him a publishing deal with Combine Music, where he mingled with Christofferson, Dennis Lind, Tony Joe White, and other heavies. His first solo album, New Beginnings, had come out that spring and was already a favorite of Jim's. One of the emerging indie studios in Nashville, Creative Workshop had been outfitted in a faux forest theme. Artificial tree trunks surrounded the isolation booth. Renting out the studio for filming was a costly expense, and there was no sign of Wilson anywhere. After hours of waiting, Graham started calling all the local hotels one by one, while Zlapsky and the crew became antsy. It seemed they may have made a fatal mistake, coming to film in an unfamiliar town far from home, running on the blind faith that a full-length film would find them in a matter of weeks. If we blow this, thought Leader about the first scene, it's a horrible way to start the film. Again, Lord, from the Hoopy River, my name. Leader finally located Wilson and drove to his motel to rouse him from bed and coax him to the studio. He was near comatose, Leader remembered, totally hungover. Wilson's voice was full of morning rust, and he was running on nothing but a cup of black coffee, which made what followed even more miraculous. He was only replaying a song from his new record with pickup musicians he'd never met before, but as soon as Wilson sat down and started warming up, the scene came together just as Jim had envisioned. It was a completely natural demonstration of how a track forms organically in the studio. It was the cornerstone they needed to jumpstart the shoot. A scene that had seemed doomed instead became an omen of good fortune to come.
Heading my way, thank you. Oh, thank you. Driver said, son, I just had to ask. Did you find yourself a greener pasture? No, sir. Said, no, sir. Met a few people that's friends of mine. Most of Utah's been unkind. Salt Lake City can do without me. There's some folks in Georgia that care a little about me. I'm leaving home as soon as I can, Lord.
After Towns died, Susanna infrequently left her room. Clark faithfully tended to her as she spent the last years of her life smoking cools in a bathrobe while taking pills for a growing number of physical ailments.
Some women wear passion like the most recent fashion. Some women want money for love.
When she died in 2012, Clark wrote, "My favorite picture of you," about a Polaroid John Lomax took of Susanna outside 1307 Chapel Avenue. Guy in Towns had driven her to fury, and she was caught glaring at the camera. Clark sang over the faintest mariachi chords. A fire in your eyes, heart on your sleeve, a curse on your lips, but all I can see is beautiful. With the onset of old age, Clark contracted diabetes and had three toes removed. He withstood lymphoma, double knee replacement, cataract surgery, a sinus operation, and an arterial bypass. While his old pals embraced sobriety, Clark remained regally unrepentant. He refused to give up his hand-rolled cigarettes and only quit drinking after chemotherapy killed his sense of taste. He only abandoned cocaine, he claimed, because it had become too difficult to procure the really good stuff. Young songwriters continued to search out Clark into his old age, visiting with him at his kitchen table above which hung Susanna's painting of the shirt, or in the playing guitar workshop he kept in the basement, where he built flamenco guitars on a bench presided over by Jim McGuire's black and white portrait of Towns. Clark was polite and insightful and always got laughs from his guests, though he usually responded to stock questions with a long supply of stock answers. He liked to say he planned on returning to Texas someday, as soon as he broke even. It was a good line. When asked about the old days in Nashville, Clark always said it was like Paris in the 20s, until he finally tired of hearing the quote repeated back to him. "I don't know if that's accurate," he said, "but it felt like it." If Zalapsky had rolled film a year earlier or a year later, it wouldn't have been the same documentary. Players, songs, and location would have aligned in different combinations. In its richness of vision and completeness of execution, the film disguised the precarious chain of coincidences that brought it into existence. Heartworn Highways became an indelible time capsule for viewers who never experienced the times themselves. For those that did, the film could serve as a sobering intrusion on happily indistinct and highly personal memories. And where most of the world saw a document of unsung musical heroes in their prime, Zalapsky's friends found an image of Jim. Though he never appeared on screen, his observational wisdom, curiosity, and humility left an invisible self-portrait embedded in every frame.
You just heard Sam Sweet reading some excerpts from his liner notes that are in the Heartworn Highways box set that came out last Record Store Day.
I think we still have some copies available.
Hopefully we do.
Online.
Thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.